Support for Sound Effect comes from WSECU. Local to Washington, WSECU is a credit union founded in public service. Today, WSECU serves more than 260,000 members. More information is available at wsecu.org. WSECU, serving Washington since 1957.
We're going to go walking. Do you remember where?
Baker Lake.
That's right. We're at the Baker Lake Trailhead. What did you bring?
Doritos and water.
If we see a bear, what are you going to do?
It depends on what kind of bear. Is it a black bear or a grizzly bear?
Grizzly.
You curl up and cover your head.
Okay, while you're doing that, I'm running.
You can't outrun a bear.
But I can run faster than you.
What?
Hey, I'm Gabriel Spitzer. You're listening to Sound Effect, and this is my coworker Jeffrey Reddick. That's his daughter Lily there. He's planning to abandon to the bears. The two of them, plus Jeffrey's wife and six-year-old son Alton, are about to set out on a hike. They wind through a wooded trail and over ice-cold streams.
Wow, look at the patterns on the rock!
Yeah, this used to be a bridge, and it fell down. Now there's another bridge. See it?
Yeah!
As they near a backwoods campsite overlooking the lake, the six-year-old does what six-year-olds do once you're miles from any building with plumbing.
A toilet's a go body.
Well, have I got a surprise for you. Come here. What is it?
Toilet. Don't even fuss.
This isn't just any toilet. It's a solitary, open-air vault toilet surrounded by nothing but woods. It looks like it's been dropped from an airplane or something.
Do you want me to walk down the trail and stand guard? Stand out of sight?
Yeah, so that no one sees me.
Again, there are no walls here, so there's no hiding from other hikers or park rangers or your mom.
Wait. I'm supposed to stand guard.
I gotta go, too. I had a lot of coffee and water.
Using the bathroom is universal. Whether you're in the woods or an office or an airplane, you bring your biological needs with you. And even though relieving oneself is part of being human, it's often not part of the conversation. Toilets figure into huge issues. Health, socioeconomic status, politics. And yet we don't talk about them because, you know, yuck. Well, today on our show, we're going all in talking about toilets, how these things we just as soon ignore actually have a profound effect on our lives and our society. And this is actually the second time we've done this. So yeah, it's an hour of toilet stories coming up right here on Sound Effect. So, what if you don't happen to be on a trail where some thoughtful toilet gnome has installed an open-air privy? In 1989, a young woman named Kathleen Meyer published a book called How to Shit in the Woods. For a book whose title can't be said on the radio, it has done really well. It's now in its third edition with 2.5 million copies sold. It's been spotted on a coffee table in a nunnery, at a bed and breakfast in Scotland, and in the library at McMurdo Station in Antarctica. Meyer lives in Montana, and she's a passionate advocate for the ideas in the book. She gives talks and readings, and even travels internationally to consult with outdoor groups that want to, well, do better. We spoke with Kathleen about why she cares so much about this stuff.
I think what started me and what keeps me going is just seeing the horror that people leave behind. I mean, if you talk to rangers, they're in the back country picking up people's poop, piles of it. And, you know, if you have a lovely lake that you like to go and camp on and you get there and there's toilet paper tucked in the bushes and all under the rocks. And I mean, I've gotten to the point where I take a pair of gloves and plastic bags in case I have to pick things up. But I guess it's my heartbreak. It's to see places like that and want to just do something about it.
So how does it feel then to be the poop lady?
Well, you know, I got used to that a long time ago. And it's not the poop lady. It's the four-letter scatological expletive that we can't say on the radio. Starts with an S.
So we have a whole book with, let's see here, how many chapters have you got in this thing? We've got 7 chapters. Why do we need a whole book about this? Why wouldn't this just fit on a 3x5 card that says pack it out?
Well, I think we need both, actually. There's a lot more to it than what you see on those little signs. If we look at the subtitle of my book, which is An Environmentally Sound Approach to a Lost Art, we have 2 things in that subtitle. One is to do things environmentally, ecologically, and then the other is the lost art part. We are now numerous generations brought up on flushing apparatus. We don't know how to squat. We don't have squatting muscles. We don't have balance. And so what my mission was with this book was to bring this subject out into the air and into the sunshine and make it a topic that people became more comfortable talking about and figuring out techniques for. And it's fun, to my mind, once you get into it. And there's a lot to learn about the intestinal pathogens that we have to be careful of, and how to go about digging an environmentally sound hole, how deep and where you want to find a spot that has lots of humus so that there is good breakdown. And then they teach, the outdoor schools came up several years ago with a practice called stirring, which sounds fairly disgusting. But stirring brings more of your deposit in connection with the humus that's in the side of the hole. You kind of loosen part of the side of the hole up and stir everything up, and then it biodegrades much faster. And then women was a big issue for me because, you know, men have it so easy just turning their backs and unzipping, and where women, we have to bare our bums. I mean, until I learned a good way to not pee in my boots, I was doing that for years. And I finally discovered that if I was sitting on a rock or a log and I had another rock or a log that I could put my feet up on, then I wasn't watering my shoes. So, but that took me several years to figure out.
There is just a proliferation of like gadgets and gear and pack it out equipment. I wonder if you could just mention a couple of your favorites or the ones you think are the most interesting.
Well, I like a poop tube because you can make it yourself out of PVC pipe that you have 2 ends on that you can unscrew. And so what you do is you either have paper bags that are little ones that are preceded with something like kitty litter. And then you either scoop with a trowel or a stick or something, you scoop it in what you've done into the bag, and then you shove that into the poop tube. And then you, when you get to a trailhead outhouse, you can just push it on through, take another piece of toilet paper and push it on through, and then take it home and wash it.
So it's like you're carrying around one of those like bank deposit tubes full of
Exactly. Exactly. Hey, that puts me in mind.
This is how innovation
Perfect.
Happens.
Yeah.
How would you sort of advise people to make pooping in the woods, you know, part of the experience of appreciating the outdoors and coexisting with nature rather than a nuisance activity that has to be, you know, endured?
Well, I think the biggest thing is to try anyway to plan ahead so that you can get far enough away from your group or off a trail and find a spot that has a panoramic view that you can commune with while you're sitting there. And it doesn't have to be a long distance view of mountain ranges. It can be something up close, maybe just one little wildflower.
It sure sounds like part of your mission is to demystify this taboo subject. And I wonder if you feel like you're making any progress.
Oh, I feel definitely like I'm making progress because I hear from so many people that are helped by it and that now get out in the backcountry and enjoy it and that are also concerned as I am about it. So, yeah, I am. But then I'm also disheartened at what I still see. So that just keeps me going.
Still work to be done.
Still work to be done. There must be some better way to say that. Some funnier way to say that.
Never mind. Kathleen Meyer is the author of How to in the Woods. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is Sound Effect. Today on our show, we're talking toilets, something that Mark Lloyd does a lot.
What we have here is a bucket, and it's got a bunch of plastic bags, some litter, some toilet paper, some hand sanitizer, some wipes, and then we have a tent, and in the tent, we have a seat that goes on the toilet.
Mark assembles these rudimentary toilets. He guesses he's done about 75 to 100 of them now, and he just gives them away.
I'm here with your toilet.
Awesome.
This is something he's been doing for about 3 years now, ever since he noticed homeless encampments springing up in his Judkins Park neighborhood. Today, we're at a collection of about 10 tents near the I-90 on-ramp on Rainier Avenue.
Here I am, Mark.
All right.
Dude, I'm so glad you came right now, because I totally forgot, and I was just getting ready to leave, and I was like, damn it.
We meet this woman in a cream-colored fleece and a plaid hair wrap. She'd rather not give her name, but she's been living here in a gray-green tent for quite a while.
Okay, awesome. Yeah, can we set it up back here?
Yeah, sure, well, I can show you how to do it.
Mark positions the bucket with all the supplies. It's up to the residents here to bag up the waste and dispose of it when it gets full. And that's an innovation, actually. Mark says that he'd started out with chemical toilets, but he found that he was spending every weekend servicing them all himself. So he went with simple. A 5-gallon bucket, kitty litter, and a little green army surplus tent for privacy.
Is it like, so it's a pop-up tent?
It's a pop-up.
Okay.
When he first saw the encampments spreading in his neighborhood, his impulse was to wade right into them, meet the people, and find out what they need.
Exactly. Who are the people that are living there? And why is it nobody seems to really know what to do?
And what do you think explains why you had that reaction rather than somebody should get this garbage and these people out of my neighborhood?
Because it was clear that the problem was big enough that you couldn't do that. And also, it was really clear that the city was almost paralyzed.
With the people came the refuse, including plenty of human waste. Mark found that kind of confounding.
In many ways, we're a very prosperous city, but we have people living in tents, in camps that have really no working sanitation.
So Mark quietly set about finding solutions. He doesn't seek out attention, he has no backing from any nonprofit or church, and he doesn't ask for donors.
Well, that's awesome. Nice. Do you do that out of your own pocket?
Or? Yeah.
Wow, that's actually amazing.
Mark says he knows this is all just a drop in the bucket. Those are his words. But it can make a big difference.
Yeah, it's so much better than just like having a bucket or something, you know what I mean? And then, like, most of the people, they go around here on the trees and stuff, and I try to get them to like not do that.
The woman says she's been looking forward to getting one of Mark's setups ever since she saw one that he'd made for her neighbor, Jay.
I talked to Jay when I first seen his little toilet. I was like, where did you get that little cute tin? That's perfect for a toilet. He was like, Mark, you haven't met him? I was like, no. So that's like last time when you came out and you gave us those garbage bags and those blue and white gloves. Do you remember that?
Oh, I remember that. Yeah.
And so you notice all the trash is gone. And
it looks a lot better.
She remarks on how other people have come here to help too, but they seemed kind of impersonal, like they were just fulfilling an obligation. Mark says these relationships are a big part of the point. And as he gets to know people, he finds that they often surprise him.
What do you like to do, like, for a living, like, besides this? I do
a lot of stuff. My day job?
Yeah, like,
computers. Computer networks. You know the internet? I work on the systems the computer, the internet runs on.
Okay, well, I took AutoCAD, and so doing AutoCAD, yeah, we had a part of it. We had to do Photoshop. We had to do blueprint reading. Yeah, so I can do more things than the average girl can do, actually.
For Mark Lloyd, sanitation is important. But it's really kind of a means to an end.
I mean, I really like giving out toilets and feeling like I'm doing something there, but I feel the most value when I've been able to sort of help someone out who I've gotten to know. You know, taking them to the hospital, talking to them about getting them maybe into drug treatment, connecting them with people that I know in the city to get them into housing.
The way people respond to those offers vary widely. Sometimes a person seems receptive and grateful, but then he never hears from them again.
Like, there was somebody I don't know if we're going to meet today. She's pregnant and has not been getting prenatal care. And plus, she has some addiction issues. And so I had a conversation with her and I said, hey, I'm going to be out. I got a toilet. And if you want, we can go up to Swedish.
Swedish Medical Center has a walk-in prenatal care clinic on Tuesdays. Mark's hoping to give her a lift there today.
Haven't heard back. But you have to have a tolerance for that. That sometimes you try to help somebody and you think, oh, they really want help, and other times not.
So we just walked down the on-ramp toward I-90, then we hopped up over a little concrete wall.
While Mark waits for the pregnant woman to text him back, we head to another nearby camp where a young woman named Megan is waiting for a replacement toilet. Mark's also bringing her a Sharps container for used needles.
So how are you doing?
I'm all right.
I brought you your toilet.
Cool. Awesome. Thank you.
Bought you one of these?
Thank you. At this encampment, I've only been here for a few months, but I mean, we've pretty much been in the same area for probably about a year, year and a half, you know.
Megan lives here with her boyfriend. She says this simple setup, a bucket and a tent, brings humanity back to this pretty scruffy campsite.
It makes a huge difference because usually, like without that, we're like having to squat in the bushes and stuff like that, and no privacy whatsoever. And people come around the corner, and I like see you, and it's just like, it's really, really invasive, you know. So, but with these things, there's like privacy, and I know that I've had like way less UTIs and stuff like that because of it, and you know, so it makes it a lot better for us.
So you've noticed that you yourself have been healthier because of this?
Yeah, definitely healthier. Yeah, that's for sure.
Mark's work makes these encampments a little healthier and a little easier to live in. But once we're back in the car, Mark acknowledges that, to some people, this looks like enabling a dangerous lifestyle. He doesn't really buy it, but he gets that way of thinking.
Oftentimes, people are living in a very bad situation and struggling with drug addiction, and they're struggling with all sorts of things. And one can argue that you're making it easier for that. And I can accept that. Some people who help out homeless people really don't like that. I'm quite happy to accept that, and I try to own that, and I always feel like I have to do enough that any of that I'm sort of counterbalancing.
Mark says he's willing to confront those gray areas, that to tackle really intractable problems like homelessness and addiction, you may have to get your hands a little dirty.
You know, I have a saying that is, if you have moral clarity, you aren't in deep enough. I think a lot of people want to be in a situation where they feel like you're the good guy and you're doing really good work and the whole world's better because of what you're doing. And I try to do things that do better, but I'm quite willing to accept that something I do may actually have some sort of blowback or maybe not helping people in the way I want to. And if that's the case, I've got to, you know, maybe I got to adjust what I'm doing.
Take today. That pregnant young woman that Mark was hoping to meet and take to prenatal care, well, she never returns his messages. Mark says you just have to accept that sometimes people aren't ready for the help or don't want it. Still, Mark says the work can bring rich rewards. There are plenty of examples.
One of the funnest ones was a gentleman that lived up near, actually near I-5 and I-90, the camp you were at, and he ended up being sent to the hospital because he was in terrible shape. He's an older gentleman. And I had got him a toilet, and I had got to know him over the years. He's quite a character. And so myself and my other friend, we would visit him over in the hospital. And first time I talked to him, he talked about his family. The second time I was there, I said, you know, well, can I try to get in touch with your daughter?
The guy had been estranged from his daughter for a long time. But when Mark made the suggestion, he agreed to let Mark call her.
And I was sitting there with my phone with one of these, you know, video chats of them talking for the first time in years. And they ended up getting together, and he still can be a challenging person, but he's reconciled with his daughter.
It's something that might not have happened if Mark hadn't taken the time to get to know this man as a human being. It's a connection that, in this case, and many others, started with a toilet. Of course, the problem of how to handle bathroom needs in public spaces probably won't be solved by one guy. In Seattle, the city's trying to find solutions to reduce the amount of human waste that winds up outside. David Jones is the city auditor, and he's investigated what Seattle is doing to tackle the problem.
And what we found in the course of doing our audit work was that there were only 6 bathrooms in the entire city of Seattle that were funded by the city that were open 24/7.
2 of those bathrooms are at Green Lake, and they're in pretty good shape, but the other public toilets are often unusable.
They often were dirty, had needles in them, and actually sometimes people would camp out in them, which made it difficult to go in and clean them. And also what we found out, I know, like in Lake City when we did our field work there, you know, you could see fecal matter in the area around it, that people obviously weren't able to go there and use it for whatever reason.
As Seattle looks to clean up its mess, the auditor's office says we should check out what San Francisco is doing. That city has also long struggled with keeping its public toilets usable. These days, they invest $5 million a year maintaining those toilets. And according to Seattle's auditor, they've had quite a bit of success. Rachel Gordon is a spokeswoman for San Francisco's Public Works Department. She told me that back in 2014, city officials decided to take on the problem of human waste in public after hearing complaints from students.
There were some kids from a school called the DeMarillac Academy, which is really targeted for inner city kids. And they were asked, well, what do you want in this budget? And they didn't hesitate. They didn't miss a beat. And they said, what we want is to be able to walk to and from school without having to worry about stepping in human waste, stepping through urine, stepping around feces. That's how they navigate getting to school. So that afternoon, we came back to our offices at City Hall for Public Works and thought, what is it we could do to make sure that there are places for people to go to the bathroom?
So my sense is that, like Seattle, or probably even before Seattle, in the early aughts in particular, that San Francisco tackled this problem in a large part through kind of engineering, elaborately designed public restrooms that cleaned themselves, that were lockable, that sort of tried to answer with design a lot of these problems. Is that correct? And how did that go?
It's somewhat correct. So it's more than 20 years ago now that J.C. Decaux, which is the French public furniture company, came into town and provided 25 of these kind of, at the time, high-tech self-cleaning toilets in largely tourist areas in downtown, but also in some other areas. So those toilets worked quite well for a long time, but they started to get abused, frankly, and we started to see that as time went on, that some of the areas, again, talking about they were used for the wrong purposes, drug dealing, drug use, prostitution, some of them were even being used for makeshift tents or encampments. So we really started to think about what we could do to make toilets be used as toilets again. And it's a very, very simple thing, and that's to have an attendant there. What makes a pit stop, that's what we named our program, San Francisco Pit Stop. What makes a pit stop is that there's staffing there, and that has made all the difference in the world.
So who is it that staffs these bathrooms, and what kind of training do they get? And what does that look like?
the folks are generally lifers, people who are coming out of prison. It's either state or federal prison after 15, 20, 25 years. This is their first job that they've had coming out of prison. These are people who have been pretty hardcore criminals in their early lives. A lot of them had been involved in gangs. They've been involved in drug use and drug dealing. They've given their time. They deserve a break to come back and be contributing members of society. And that's what they've shown. So the training they get is, you know, show up on time, look presentable. They do have uniforms. They all have Narcan, which is a way that you can revive someone quickly after an overdose. They've been trained how to use that. And on many occasions in San Francisco, they've done that, not just for the people who are using the pit stops who might have overdosed inside, but really for a lot of the people outside of the pit stops, because they're in these very challenging neighborhoods where there's a lot of open drug use. And so they've always stepped up. The attendant will also go in after each use and make sure that the bathroom's looking pretty good. So we want to make sure that there's soap in the sink, that the sink is wiped down, that there's not garbage left on the floor. We've had an incredible track record with these people.
Yeah. And do you find that the attendants make the bathrooms more welcoming? I mean, do they ever personalize them or do anything?
Yeah, it's really, so the attendants are a couple of things about them. They really take ownership in the pit stops. They want to make sure they're clean. We've had some attendants who have put potted plants in their pit stops, who make sure there's air freshener available, who have, there's not only soap in there, but they may have other hand sanitation things or nice towels there. We talked to one woman who said that after using the pit stop, it was the first time in many, many years since she was a girl, she said, and she was in her 30s, I believe, and homeless for many years. It's the first time she really felt kind of being home, that she felt safe and comfortable being in a bathroom. You know, we've had not only are the potted plants, some of the attendants have brought in magazines or newspapers. We don't want people to stay in there to read all the sections of a newspaper, but we want them to just be able to be human again. It's a cliche to say, but to be able to go to the bathroom with dignity. If we look at the data of where people have been relieving themselves that's not in a toilet, it's often between parked cars, it's in doorways, it's in darkened parking garages or parking lots. It's places where people can't be seen. The pit stop program is a way to let people kind of take care of their personal business in an appropriate place. When you talk about costs, there certainly are costs involved. With limited hours, they're not open 24 hours right now, costs on average about $200,000 a year per bathroom. That is a cost there, but then you have to think what kind of cost savings there may be.
And so how do you judge success then? What is the threshold for saying that this is worth it?
So there are a couple of ways to judge success. We calculate, although they're not open, again, 24 hours a day, but if you average out the use over 24 hours, a pit stop is used about every 2 minutes in San Francisco. We just hit our 1 millionth flush last fall, and we see a steady increase in the usage of all the toilets in San Francisco. There was one near City Hall in particular that just really blew our minds, that it was getting about 500 uses a month prior to it being staffed, and we've gone as high as 5,000 uses a month. More or less, it's usually around 2,500 to 3,000. It's really important to note that these toilets are really for use by everybody. It's not just people who are unhoused who are using them, but we've got the Uber and Lyft drivers. We have school groups. The one toilet I talked to you about near City Hall, there's a farmer's market there twice a week, and they were pleading for help from both the customers and the vendors who needed somewhere to go, particularly on a Sunday when the civic buildings around there are closed.
So what would you say the most important and most compelling lessons are from San Francisco's experience that could be applied to a place like Seattle?
So I think there are a few things that need to be done. One is to have it driven by data. We wanted to put the pit stops where they were being used most. And for us, the data we used were steam cleaning requests. And we can break down our steam cleaning requests. We don't break it down between dog and human feces, but if there's feces on the ground and someone calls our 311 customer service center, we will go and respond. We prioritize those calls.
So do you find that this pit stop approach solves the problem? And if not, what are the shortcomings? What are the challenges that remain?
Yeah, certainly it's not solving the problem. We still have a problem in San Francisco, as I think a lot of urban America does, with people relieving themselves in public places where they shouldn't be doing that. We've had a number of times when we've seen people who will pull down their pants and either pee or poop, you know, half a block or a block away from a pit stop when it's available for use. As long as we're going to have mental illness, as long as we have drug and substance abuse problems and people may not be quite aware of how to behave civilly, just because you have a public toilet there doesn't mean that people are automatically going to be using it, but at least that tool is available to them. They have that option to use a toilet where they may not have had it before.
That's Rachel Gordon of San Francisco's Public Works Department. Here in Seattle, the auditor's office is recommending the city pilot a pit stop program here, but no word yet on whether that will happen. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme today is toilets. Serious business now. Toilet snakes, toilet rats, killer peacicles. There are a lot of toilet tales out there that maybe don't smell quite right. So we decided to Snopes that, meaning we hit up Tacoma resident David Mickelson, who is founder of the fact-checking website Snopes.com. The site may have turned its focus more toward politics lately, but over the last 25 years, it's accumulated an impressive library of toilet myths, urban legends, and occasionally hard-to-believe true stories. He joined us in our Tacoma studios to help us make sense of it all. What did you find out about the invention of the toilet?
Well, it's sort of a legend that the flush toilet, the modern flush toilet, was invented by a man named Thomas Crapper, and that's why Crapper is sort of a, you know, vulgar or slang synonym for toilet to this day. But that idea was largely spread by a less than accurate biography called Flushed with Pride. You know, Thomas Crapper was a sort of a sanitary engineer or plumber, as we might call him, in London, you know, over 100 years ago. He did hold some patents on, you know, plumbing-related inventions. He did manufacture and sell plumbing items, including flush toilets, but he did not actually invent the modern flush toilet. That's, you know, a case of you know, something else being attributed to kind of a more appropriate or well-known name.
Anything in that suggests, like, I don't know, the mechanics of how an urban legend comes to be or a misinterpretation of history?
Well, I'd say in this sense, it's largely driven by his, you know, now seemingly unfortunate surname. That's just too good a coincidence to pass up, that a man named Crapper was somehow involved with toilets, and somebody along the way is bound to make the obvious connection, you know, even though it's not true, that, oh, he invented these things. That's why they're called crappers, you know.
So let's talk about toilet snakes and rats and lizards and whatever else. Uh-huh. There's always these stories about some kind of critter crawling out from the pipes out of the toilet, uh-huh, sometimes when someone's sitting on it, and hilarity slash terror ensues. So does that stuff really happen?
It does. I mean, probably not nearly as much as is claimed, but it's certainly not unknown that rats and snakes and other things will come up sewage pipes. And, you know, more than one unfortunate homeowner has found a rat swimming around in his toilet bowl or a snake crawling around in one. Most people think that couldn't happen because surely they drown, but piping has a lot more openings and a lot more air spaces than most people think.
So there's like air pockets and stuff like that?
Yes, especially, you know, plumbing, you know, dips and goes around bends and things like that. It's not just, you know, completely 100% filled with water all of the way, that, you know, and smaller critters can make their way through it and find enough air pockets to keep going till they eventually reach an exit somewhere, which in some cases turns out to be the one that opens into the toilet bowl.
Well, on a related note, something you wrote about with somewhat extensively was about the sort of alligators in the sewers question.
A
lot of times these originate with, you know, the idea of maybe a baby alligator gets flushed down the toilet, or people release a pet and they find their way into the sewers, and then there's a thriving colony under New York City of alligators. So is that true, and how did you go about investigating it?
Well, yeah, in general, no, it's not true, I mean, at least in the sense of there are no, you know, thriving colonies of alligators living in the sewers of New York or anywhere else. And I think, as we pointed out, it's really, you know, a New York sewer would be a completely inhospitable environment for an alligator to live in the first place. As I recall, you know, we did a whole lot of tracing. There was like maybe one report of an alligator being found in a sewer in New York way back in the 1920s, and, you know, a whole lot of legendary about it ever since. So I think maybe in a few places there have been occasions where maybe like a full-grown one managed to crawl into some kind of underground sewage system, but, you know, not infant creatures making their way through being flushed and growing to maturity.
So when I was growing up, I was regularly on the lookout for frozen feces and urine falling from the sky that, you know, originate from airplane toilets. How worried should I be?
Blue ice, I think, as they call it. It's kind of, again, a misperception, you know, that, you know, the toilets on airplanes just, you know, opened into empty space. So when you flush them, the stuff went right out of the plane and, you know, spewed over wherever the plane was flying over at the moment. But of course, they don't do that, and they're not allowed to do that. For the most part, kind of those legends are fostered by sometimes ice forms on the outside of airplanes and, you know, may break off and fall to the ground. And people think that stuff that came out of a toilet, you know, there may have been a few occasions over the year where, you know, inadvertently, the holding tanks on a plane, you know, got a leak or a rupture and some unfortunate material came out. But they certainly don't just willy-nilly dump things out from, you know, 30,000 feet, and they're not allowed to do that either.
Well, what about that picture of the woman impaled on with a golden javelin of frozen pee?
A frozen shaft of urine, yes. That was kind of one of, like, the seminal, internet fake photos, that it was just, something that was fabricated for an article somewhere. I don't think it even originated on the internet. I think someone scanned it in from a print publication, but completely out of context, it was, you know, circulated on the internet for years, along with the caption that, yes, a falling frozen shaft of urine from an airplane had impaled this person, you know, standing on the ground and killed him.
I wonder. I mean, toilets are sort of uniquely taboo in certain ways. I mean, we don't like to talk about those things in public. I mean, on our show, we seem to not have any problem with it. But I wonder, does that also lend itself to these types of explanations, fantasies, stories, and legends?
Certainly. Yeah, it's probably not a kind of legend that would be told now that we're not so squeamish about toilets. But, you know, there were a number of sort of embarrassment legends that played on those. Like a prominent one several decades ago was a woman who's attending, say, a party in a house and goes to use the restroom or the bathroom, not knowing that it had been recently repainted, including inexplicably the toilet seat itself, hadn't quite dried. So she sits down to use the toilet and finds that when she's done, she can't get back up because the not quite dry paint has sort of glued her buttocks to the seat. And the homeowner has to come and unscrew the seat to get her loose from the toilet and then take her to the emergency room to try and have a doctor separate her skin from the seat. The punchline generally being that the woman exclaims to the doctor, you know, "Have you ever seen anything like this before?" You know, kind of nervously. And the doctor says, "Well, yes, but I believe this is the first time I've ever seen one framed." It's also, you know, again, kind of there seems to be quite an intersection between toilets and television. One of the sort of the persistent legends, you know, is like some widely watched television broadcast, you know, anything from the Super Bowl to the final episode of, say, MASH, something that millions and millions of people are watching simultaneously, breaking a local sewage system when all the people got up at the end of the program to go and use the bathroom and flush simultaneously. Yet it doesn't make a whole lot of sense given that, anything from, the last episode of MASH was 2.5 hours long, the Super Bowl is 3 hours plus. Those things all have plenty of commercial breaks all throughout them. It's not like everyone has to hold it in until the very last moment. And I think there was one example where there's some town's sewage system actually did break at the same time the Super Bowl was going on, but it was a rather antiquated system with a lot of weak points, and it was kind of only a matter of time till that happened. So probably really coincidental with the fact that it was Super Bowl Sunday.
So I wonder, tell me if I'm wrong, but I get the sense that these types of urban legends were kind of the bread and butter for Snopes early on, and that and obviously, as you said, you've moved in a little bit of a more substantive direction in terms of looking into politics and all manner of global public affairs. And I wonder, do you ever miss just a good old-fashioned toilet snake story?
Yeah, I do miss the kind of material we used to do about urban legends. Although, certainly things related to toilets fall into the embarrassment class of legends, and just one of the artifacts of modern society is there's a lot less that we're really supremely embarrassed about these days that could form the basis for those kind of legends. We went from, not showing toilets on television to now, movies and TV shows routinely feature characters, sitting on toilets in stalls conversing with each other. So, there's really no taboo or embarrassment factor to it anymore.
Well, we on Sound Effect are doing our part to, help really scuff up the public dialogue as much as possible. David Mickelson, founder of Snopes.com and Tacoma resident, thank you so much for coming in to talk toilets with us.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today's show is all about toilets. Okay, so up or down? The great toilet seat debate may sound kind of funny, but when you share a commode, say in an office, it can be deadly serious. This came up recently at a certain alt-weekly newspaper in Seattle.
I am Katie Herzog, and I'm a staff writer at The Stranger.
My name's Lester Black, and I'm a staff writer at The Stranger.
Katie and Lester have pretty different thoughts about how people should leave the lid. And if you think you know where this is going, keep listening. This is not your typical battle of the sexes bickering. We dropped by The Stranger to shed some new light on an old problem.
It all started with one of my colleagues, Natalie Graham, writing something on a Friday afternoon calling out the men of the office for leaving the toilet seat raised. The gender that is most often sullying the toilet seat is men. Men are to be blamed for making the toilet seat dirty in general, but everyone has an interest in making sure that toilet seat is clean. So I have thought about it for a while, and I've come to the logical conclusion that leaving the toilet seat raised is actually an insurance policy on making sure that toilet seat never has any dribbles of urine on it.
I really appreciate that Lester took a lot of time to think about this. I think that he got one thing wrong, though. The philosophical principle that I try to live by is utilitarianism. So, under utilitarianism, you act in the way that brings the greatest happiness to the greatest number of people. And at The Stranger, there are more women than there are men in the editorial department where we share the toilets. There are, by my count, 12 females and 9 males. there's a more than 50% chance that the person using the toilet after or before Lester is going to use it in the sitting down position. So by his logic, he's forcing everybody to touch the toilet. By my logic, if you put it down every time, there's a less than 50% chance that the person after you needs to touch the toilet. So he's just like, he's like mansplaining the toilet situation.
I respect Katie's utilitarianism. I think there's a lot to be learned from utilitarianism, but not when it's applied in the wrong direction. And it seems that Katie's main application of utilitarianism here is to avoid having to touch a toilet seat, which is not what I think the main problem of using the bathroom is. And honestly, this aversion is concerning to me. I think that it says something revealing. Is Katie Herzog washing her hands when she leaves the bathroom?
I don't just wash my hands after I use the toilet every single time. I wash my face and most of my upper body. I am appalled by this ad hominem attack, Lester.
If you're washing your hands, it doesn't matter if the seat is up or down. It doesn't matter if you have to touch the toilet seat. The only thing that should matter is that there is a clean toilet seat and you're washing your hands and your hands are clean when you leave.
When you walk into a bathroom and the toilet seat is up, it looks dirty. Even if it's actually cleaner than it is, even if there's less likelihood that there's going to be urine dribble on the top of the seat, it still looks bad. And so, I don't know, it looks like a frat house. It looks like just a place where men monopolize and don't have any respect for the women in their lives, Lester.
We're bringing up aesthetics at this point, which I think is interesting because aesthetically, a lowered toilet seat is not pleasing. What is aesthetically pleasing is a lowered lid. If we're going to start lowering the lid, which I would be interested in discussing, that would also bring up the fact that people of all genders and types of relieving themselves would need to touch the toilet seat. So this, I think, might be a concern to someone like Katie who doesn't like the toilet seat and perhaps is washing her hands, but we don't know.
I think closing the lid makes the bathroom look better, it makes it look cleaner. I think that would be a good solution. Plus, the fact that when you close the toilet lid before you flush, it prevents all of the particulate matter that is within the toilet from being released into the air, which is also very disgusting.
You're telling me that you would agree right now to always close the lid before flushing and exit with lid closed?
Yes.
I could agree to that too.
Katie Herzog and Lester Black are staff writers at The Stranger. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestead, Jennifer Wing, and Posey Gruner. We had help this week from Jeffrey Reddick, Paige Hansen, Aaron Hennessy, and Kari Ploeg. Our intern is Max Wasserman, and Matt Martinez is our executive producer. This is the perfect week to subscribe to our podcast, which you can find on Apple Podcasts, NPR One, Spotify, or wherever. Take a listen to some old episodes, including our first episode about toilets. See, we did one of these back in 2015, and there were just so many great stories that we just had to go do a number two. Do you find potty talk refreshing or disgusting? Send your feedback to soundeffect@knkx.org or find us on Facebook. We're back next week when our theme is personal space. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is KNKX.